All right.
The court is ready to hear argument in 7581 N. Ray Schmitz. The Chief Justice is not sitting.
May it please the court, Ms. McComas will present argument for the relators. Relators have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. There's essentially one issue before the court, and that's whether a two-sentence letter from a law firm related to a merger satisfies the demand requirements under Article 5.14 of the Texas Business Corporation Act. There are three independent reasons for this court to hold that it does not. First, the letter doesn't identify a shareholder. The letter doesn't describe with particularity the act or omission complained of. And the letter does not satisfy the 90-day advance notice requirement.
How would they have described it more particularly?
How could they have? Well, they certainly, at a minimum, every jurisdiction that's written on this, and there aren't a lot, but most of the law comes from Delaware, says at a minimum there should be the identity of a wrongdoer. You should identify the injury and give a factual basis to explain what's the injury and the claim of the corporation that the shareholder's trying to take over, and then tell the board what they need to do. I mean, remember, this is a shareholder derivative action. The shareholders...
They said you're selling for 22 per share rather than 23 per share.
Right.
And one might imply from that, as a shareholder, I'd rather have 23 than 22.
For a board trying to decide what the lawsuit is about, what's the wrong with that? It's not the fact that there's a dollar difference in share alone is nothing that's an actionable legal action. You've got to tell me what the board did
Maybe
wrong.
Maybe I read too many John Grisham thrillers, but the answer is because the reason they're taking the lower price is always because the board gets more money personally that way.
If that was the accusation, they needed to put it in the letter.
But how would they know that if you all wouldn't? I mean, they didn't even know who this was, who the other bidder was.
Actually, they filed a lawsuit 3 days later that certainly had that information in it, so I think they did know who it was.
Did they know? Are they incorrect that the board failed to disclose their analysis? Is that just a lie, or was that true?
No, actually, one day before, timing-wise, there was a proxy statement in November. And then there was a subsequent proxy statement, an additional proxy statement in December, that disclosed the board's analysis entirely as to what they intended to do and what they were doing. So they had that information. The letter just simply didn't explain. And if you want to know what particularity means, that's obviously what we're here to decide today, because we don't have guidance, at least in this court, as to what that means. And I want to back up a little bit and put that in the context of the Texas statute compared to other statutes, and particularly Delaware. In 1997, our Texas legislature adopted the model code in an effort to, what they said, close the gap on the Delaware advantage. So they enacted a code that wrote in some restrictions that didn't exist even under Delaware law as to a derivative action. And in that statute, one of the things they wrote in that even under the model code doesn't exist is a requirement that the demand letter be made with particularity. And that's language we don't have elsewhere. So even in cases we've cited to you where there was substantial more information in the letter than what we have in our letter wasn't enough, I would argue under the Texas statute, particularity means something very specific. And if you want an example to apply in this case, if you look at pages 5 and 6 at Real Party's brief on the merits, they do a nice two-page summary of who they think did what that was wrong and why. And they had all that information in their petition that they filed 3 days after they sent this letter. So you have to ask yourself why they sent a letter that only had two sentences in it that was as vague as it was if they had that information available to them. Because remember, again, the point of this statute is to give the board the information they need to decide where they need to go. Whether this is asking for permission to take away from the board and the company the right to manage litigation and step into the shoes of the company to pursue a lawsuit. And the statute very carefully lays out what steps the board has to take to decide whether or not that's appropriate. And one of the things the board has to do is it has to decide whether there are independent directors that can make this consideration or whether a special committee needs to make that consideration. They have to decide whether it's in the best interest of the corporation. And that jumps us back to the question of whether the shareholder should have been identified on the letter, because our letter not only doesn't tell the board what's legally wrong with this $1 per share, it doesn't tell us who plans on bringing the lawsuit.
Is that fact alone enough?
Yes. I think both of those are independent grounds. You could hold definitely and quite narrowly, quite frankly, if you wanted to, that the absence of a shareholder named on this letter alone is enough, because that information has to be available for the board to act under the statute. The statute contemplates the board interacting with a shareholder. And if that shareholder is not named on the face of the letter, we would argue that that alone is sufficient to prohibit the lawsuit from being filed.
The plaintiffs made no assertions that such a demand would be futile?
No, and futility is not relevant under the Texas statute. That takes us back to one of the other things about Texas's code compared to the Delaware statute. The Delaware statute allows for futility, which is essentially an excuse for not making demand in the first place. Texas took that out and said, you have to make demand. There's no excuse for not making demand in the first place with the corporation. I want to go, there's a third reason why this letter is insufficient. And that's because Article 5.14, which is the statute we're talking about, also says once you send the demand letter to the corporation, you have to give the board 90 days to consider it. And there are specific things the board is doing during those 90 days. In this case, the letter was sent to the board sometime on December 20th. By its terms, the board was given less than a day to respond. The lawsuit was filed on December 23rd. And just to put it in context, that was the Friday before Christmas. So they get the demand letter on a Wednesday. The Friday before Christmas, they get a lawsuit filed. On its face, this obviously doesn't meet the 90-day requirement. So unless there's some exception, that's also a very easy way to determine that this letter didn't satisfy the minimum requirement.
In lots of notice statutes, we've said, well, but if the statute doesn't say what happens, then we have to look to the purpose of the statute, et cetera. This statute doesn't say what happens, does it?
What happens when you don't
make it? If you do it in 87 days rather than 90.
No, because it contemplates you do it in 90 days.
So, unlike Hines versus Hash, we said, 60-day notice under the DTPA. If you file less than 60 days, we're going to bait the case until the 60 days is over. So could you cure this problem here? Or what is there about the purpose of the statute that would be subverted if the ruling was, okay, well, this case is abated for 87 more days until the 90 days runs?
Well, let me go back both to plain language and purpose, I think, to answer your question. I think under the plain language, the way our statute is written is it's an absolute prohibition from ever bringing the lawsuit, and because there are other steps.
That's what people said about Hines versus Ash and the 60-day notice. But it actually didn't say absolute prohibition. It just says you have to send this 60 days before trial.
Right, right. Whereas ours is an absolute prohibition. The lawsuit never commenced. It's as if it never happened. And I think that's a difference in the statutory language. But I think there's also a difference in the purpose. The purpose under the DTPA of that 60-day requirement is to allow people to consider settling it before it goes to trial. Here, the purpose is the shareholder derivative suit itself is an exception to the general rule that the board is the one that controls all claims of the corporation. Here you have not an outsider, but a shareholder trying to come in and take advantage of an exception to do that. It never gets off the ground under this statute. You never have a right to get to step one.
You're hard to have an abated lawsuit pending when the board decides that, yes, it is going to take on this litigation and file a separate suit. Is that what you're saying? In other words, If they don't comply with the 90 days, and so if the rule is that you abate the proceeding, okay, so the board then is considering whether or not to take the case on its own, then what does it do? File its own lawsuit? Is that the discrepancy here?
If it decides it's appropriate, yeah. The statute, there are a lot of things. It's not just consider whether to settle. The board has a lot of considerations it can take into during this process and during the period of the 90-day waiting period. And that is it can put together, it needs to investigate the claim. And it's either going to do that through disinterested shareholders or a special committee, but they're going to look into this issue. And let me get back to one more purpose of the statute that I think is a little bit different, is that that's very cumbersome and time-consuming. And if you put it in the context of the facts of this case, what that would have done is it would have created a burden on this corporation and directors in the midst of putting together a merger, having to put together disinterested shareholders to also investigate that merger at the same time. I'm not saying that's always inappropriate. There are times when, of course, that's appropriate. But to invoke that and to put them through the cost, expense, the question on their business judgment, and the problems for the corporation of doing that, you have to at least make this threshold requirement. So I think it's more than just abating to give them time to do that. I think this is a threshold requirement that the statute and the legislature intended. This is step one. If you don't get it, the lawsuit never occurs.
Is there something unusual about publicity or something that goes beyond the apparent harm or cost of defending a case? Because it seems like if you hire a lawyer, you have lawyers on staff, they're going to, or on staff where you hire independent lawyers, depending, and they simply file an answer and a plea and abatement. It doesn't seem like that's going to be, when you're talking about mergers and corporate actions, that might not be such a significant detriment. But if there's something else, publicity is going to put sand in the gears of whatever you're doing, something like that. Is there something beyond that?
Of course. I do think that this statute, if you look at the legislative intent, and again, it was to make Texas a place more attractive than other jurisdictions perhaps to incorporate, that the burden is part of what they're thinking about. And it's not just the cost of filing the lawsuit, it's also the cost of investigating it, putting together a special committee, and the time burden on the board at the time that they're moving forward on significant ventures. But also, you're right. I'm sorry, I think I'm going to have to get a little water. That there would be a publicity factor there, that there's accusal of wrongdoing at the time that they're putting the corporation up for sale could have a very significant negative impact on the company.
Well, but I don't understand your argument in that respect. If the letter had been more specific, there would have been even more suggestion of wrongdoing.
Well, but the letter's not public. What the letter does is it's sent to the board, and it gives the board the right in the first instance to investigate and decide what to do with that information, whether to file a lawsuit, whether to take action separate or independent from filing a lawsuit, whether to wait. And like I said, I'm not saying that there aren't instances. This statute was written for an obvious reason, that there are instances where a shareholder should be allowed to come in and question the board's activity, but they have to do it by following the statutory prerequisites. Now, we didn't get to talk much about the 90 days, so I want to just talk about it briefly, that the only exception there is irreparable injury, or at least the only exception the real parties have tried to invoke is irreparable injury. That's irreparable injury to the corporation, not to the shareholders. And here what they're complaining about is a dollar difference in the share price for a company that's about to merge and cease to exist. If there's any injury there, it's to the shareholders' share value and not to the corporation itself. But in any event, it would be monetary. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you, counsel. Of course, ready to hear argument from the real party in interest.
May it please the court, Mr. Green will present argument for the real party in interest.
May it please the court, first on the issue of naming the shareholder, I think every lawyer has had the experience of writing something that you might have written differently if you could go back. And just to be clear from the outset, we would have avoided this whole issue if the client's name apparently had been in there, according to the defendants. But the issue that we're here on is, what does the statute require And there was a nice debate in the first argument about
seems to require more that was than a two-sentence letter saying we're going to sue you. See, the letter seems to fall very short, in my view.
Well, on naming the shareholder, the statute says a written demand is filed. And there's no mystery that the corporation knew what the demand was. The proxy statement that was issued 2 days after the demand letter refers to the demand letter. This is at volume 2 of the record, page 341. They knew exactly what the demand was. There wasn't any mystery to it. And the question arises, I think there was a question about the degree of particularity that's required. And the statute does say with particularity, and what does that mean? And the case we had guiding us before we got here was Pace versus Jordan from the First District. And that case says that particularity just means a fair opportunity for the board to consider the claim and the nature of the claim. And so the question is, how much detail do you need to give to satisfy that? That's what we were working against.
Well, but the one problem is that if you got the letter, you wouldn't know what standing Mr. Robbins had to complain if he's not a shareholder.
I understand that question.
You look on the list, he's not a shareholder. This just came out of the blue. So how does the company know that this is a complaint is being made by somebody who can actually sue and has standing to make the complaint?
In the Smalco case that the defendants have cited, I think the board sought a clarification of the letter. If there was part of it that was unclear, I think they contacted the lawyer, and that's how they found out. There's no reason that couldn't have been done here.
But the question is, are they obliged to, or are you obliged to, identify the shareholder? The standing question Justice Heck just raised is an important one. The corporation needs to see if the person who is attempting to bring the derivative action is actually a shareholder. They need to take a look and see if under some statutes, Delaware and others, if they've been a shareholder long enough. And some cases, courts are skeptical of persons who buy one share and then attempt to pursue a derivative action and bought it recently versus someone who's been a long-standing significant shareholder in the company. All of those are issues that have come up under Delaware law, and we're going to be apparently reaching, not now, in the future here in Texas. And as you know, I presume those are things that are important for courts and companies in the first instance to consider, which is one reason why there is an identification of shareholder requirement. The particularity, you're right, we're going to define here, hopefully.
I understand that, and I can only go back to the statute. It says a demand is filed, and I think there is a difference between the phrasing of the statute and the passive tense and the active tense. And we cited cases on that. The courts look at it differently, and there just isn't a requirement in the statutory language.
So you think in Texas you can file a shareholder derivative action without identifying the shareholder, period?
I think that this sort of thing is not
common
in my
experience. Well, that
sounded
like what you were just trying to say. So
I'm not trying to suggest that it should be a precedent for that. And as I say, if we could go back and do this letter differently and avoid this issue, we would.
What would be the use?
Okay, let me re-ask my question. Do you believe that in Texas you can file a shareholder derivative action without identifying the shareholder?
That's what the statute allows as I read it. The other issues that they've raised.
Can you file a shareholder derivative suit without sending a notice letter at all?
No. No, it's a universal demand statute, so that a demand is required.
How about a phone call?
It has to be in writing, according to the statute, a written demand.
Okay.
They've also argued that particular.
The question arises, is that jurisdictional to filing the lawsuit?
Complying with the statute is jurisdictional. We don't dispute that, no.
Okay,
the question
so then
what the statute.
Then the question is, should it be abated or should it be dismissed? You have the letter. As Justice Brister asked a while ago, what should this lawsuit be abated or dismissed if the letter is insufficient?
We don't dispute that it needs to be dismissed if the letter is insufficient. That's a threshold analysis under the statute. So the question is, what does the statute require? And on the particularity, the standard that we were working against before we got here was Pace versus Jordan and those elements in the Pace decision of naming the wrongdoer, the board of directors, describing the factual basis for the claim that there's a superior offer and a shareholder generally would want more. The injury was following the initial offer, the Hoshizaki offer, at a lower price. And to quote the demand letter, the board was asked to fully and fairly consider all potential offers.
So some non-shareholder out there hears about this and thinks, well, that's just not right. It should have taken a higher offer. So sends a letter in, just like the one that you have, and done. And then so then somebody else, another lawyer who does represent a shareholder, says, well, that's all we need. Somebody sent a letter, so that's notice enough. I don't need to send one now, so I can just go ahead and file suit.
I don't think that's what we have here.
But you have a letter that doesn't identify a shareholder, which wouldn't purport to stimulate the corporation to do anything without any evidence that anybody who sent this letter has actual standing as a shareholder.
I understand that, but there's no reason under the circumstances, especially when there's no dispute that the board received the letter. And the proxy, again, acknowledges receipt of the letter and the nature of the demand. And the proxy also says that the letter doesn't identify the shareholder. And there was a phone number on the letter. There was no effort to contact our firm to seek clarification. That simply means, I'm sorry.
The claim that you made ultimately was that they had sold it for an unfair price.
That's one of the issues, yes.
And doesn't the statute require that you state with particularity that complaint, that you're selling it for an unfair price?
It requires pleading the act, omission, or other matter that's the subject of the claim, and that was certainly the essence of it. But Pace tells us that you don't essentially have to send your petition to the board with your letter,
no,
or have that be your letter.
But your letter has to state the claim.
Yes.
You're selling it for an unfair price.
Correct.
And I don't see that in the letter. Maybe I'm missing something. I understand that you can perhaps imply that from the letter, but the statute requires that you set forth with particularity, and this just says that you've gotten a superior offer and don't take any further steps until you give information. It doesn't say you're selling it for an unfair price, and I think that's one of the complaints they're making is the statute requires you actually state what your complaint is, and I don't get that from the letter.
I would take it from the word superior, that it's the superior offer, that if a shareholder has one in hand that's higher than the other.
But your claim is that it was an unfair price.
That is part of it, and I was going to get to that. The essence of it is the process that's being followed is a fair process that's going to maximize shareholder value for the sale of the company. And that's why the letter says fully and fairly consider all potential offers. And it wasn't a mystery that this strategic buyer number one was out there and had been out there since October and had made a higher offer. That much had been disclosed.
Well, I guess what I'm struggling with here is the degree of particularity as to the cause of action that's required. Because could you just write a letter and say, be sure to be fair in what you do, and that would be enough to support any cause of action that you claimed?
I don't think that would be, because it's not tethered to any facts or circumstances like we have here. In this case, we have the other offer that's out there,
okay.
And that's the gist.
You have two offers, A and B. Be fair in what you do. I mean, it seems to me there's got to be something more than just consider everything that's before you and you have an obligation to get the best price.
I understand that, but I think in the circumstances here where there isn't any mystery what we're talking about, that they know they've got this other offer, it's for a higher price, and part of the flow of events in October involved how to respond to that offer and deal with it, and it was an ongoing issue up until December.
But it doesn't say that $22 a share is an unfair price.
Looking at the text of the letter, I don't disagree with you, but I think it's sufficient to say the factual basis for the claim.
Clearly lower than 23. At least last time I looked at a number like that.
I'm not a math expert, but I tend to agree.
What the other side says, this puts a huge burden on us. We've got to go get all these committees and all this other stuff. That's why the bar needs to be real high. You agree with that or don't agree with that?
The description we've heard is that Texas needs to be an attractive place to incorporate. That's the argument that's been made, and they say that's reflected in the statute and the policies. I think there's another side to that coin, and that is that the shareholders are the owners of these public companies, and Texas also has to be an attractive place to invest, not just incorporate. So a point I wanted to get out now is maybe a good time, that I think there needs to be some balance in the standards, ultimately, that takes into account the other side of the coin.
Who does that, us or the legislature?
I think the legislature does that, but in giving some gloss to this statute, which is pretty terse, the statute itself is only one sentence, and the Pace Court tried to elaborate it and give it some meaning. And I think that's a consideration that weighs in the balance here. Unless the court has any further questions.
What about the irreparable injury? Kind of escaping the 90-day advance notice requirement.
Yeah, it's not a universal demand statute, or that you can never bring a derivative case. The exception is for irreparable injury.
And you agree with injury to the corporation.
To the corporation, that you don't need to wait the 90 days. And the injury here is the process that's being followed, that it's not possible to go back and recreate that process that will maximize the price for the shareholders. And that's it in a nutshell.
Any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
I just want to clean up a few things, particularly with reference to the proxy statement and saying that that meant that the board understood the demand and what the issue was. All that proxy statement says is, and the proxy statement came out 2 days after the demand letter was sent to the board. It says, on December 20th, the company received a one-paragraph letter by telecopy from a lawyer demanding that the company terminate its efforts to consummate the merger with Hoshizaki and pursue the offer proposed by strategic buyer one as disclosed above on page 19. The demand letter does not state the demand is on behalf of any shareholder of Lancer. The letter says, I mean, that's all the board could glean from that letter, and that's not enough to determine that there's a lawsuit out there. In fact, the proxy statement says there are no existing lawsuits. One more point on Pace. Sorry, guys, the cold.
All the investigation you were doing that already.
As far as whether the merger was in the
whether you should take 23 from one guy or 22 from the other with all the other conditions attached, you all already had been doing that for a long time.
That's right.
So that wouldn't have taken any extra to investigate.
Well, the question for the board is what's wrong with the dollar difference? That's the problem you're having.
That's what you had to decide when you were picking between those two offers.
Right, but what's the lawsuit about? What's the I don't want to say criminal act. What's the breach of fiduciary duty associated with this that the board's supposed to go investigate? That's the problem.
That you're taking an inferior offer.
But that in and of itself is not a breach of fiduciary duty if there are reasons not to take the inferior offer. It's not just the dollar amount that makes the difference.
Well, but if there are reasons, then it's not inferior.
Well, then tell me why that's a superior offer. What about that is superior that makes it a breach of fiduciary duty not to pursue it?
Well, I mean, that's just what you said in your proxy statement. If I have 1,000 shares, I'd rather have a dollar more than a dollar less. All other things being equal. All other things may not be equal, but you knew what other things were or were not equal. You weren't confused about that. You didn't have to do any investigation about that at all.
Yeah, I want to capitalize on that statement that I get a dollar more, I get a dollar less. That's kind of the crux of the problem here. The only harm we're talking about is harm to the individual shareholders. And that's the issue, is that this letter
so this shouldn't have been brought as a shareholder derivative suit at all?
Not if that was their complaint. If their complaint was for corporate waste or mismanagement that affected the value coming into the corporation, then it's a shareholder derivative suit because it's a corporate claim. If all you're complaining about is, I don't like this deal because I'm not getting enough as an individual shareholder, that's an individual shareholder complaint, and there are remedies available for that. But those remedies are appraisal rights. There are statutory steps, which, by the way, this real party chose not to take and let the merger go through without taking any action. If I can clean up one more thing real quick, the Pace case, we do cite that as the standards for wrongdoing. I do want to make clear that case does not apply the particularity requirements in the current statute. It's riding on the old statute. And the demand is filed in the passive tense on whether there has to be a shareholder. I actually take issue. I think the statute clearly contemplates that the board is communicating with the shareholder. If you look at 5.14C2, which is the 90-day requirement, it says you must wait 90 days, and one of the exceptions to that is unless rejection has been made to the shareholder. The board can't be communicating with the shareholder unless the shareholder has been identified in the demand letter.
There's an affidavit in the briefs that says that Virginia Dillingham is the shareholder. Does the record reflect when she became a shareholder or how many shares she owns?
It does not. One more thing that's worth noting is several times my opponent said they never made an effort to contact us. They had our phone number. They had the law firm's phone number. Why didn't they inquire? This statute certainly doesn't put a burden on the corporation to get the demand right in the first place, but I think there's probably a pretty easy explanation for that, too, is that there wasn't a lot of time between the time the suit was filed and the time demand was made. So, you know, if it were 90 days into it and they convened a committee and were looking into it, that might be a little less onerous of statement, but I think given the timing that that's not quite fair. Does the court have any further questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes the argument in the second case. The court will take another brief recess.
All right.